We're back. You're back.
In the saddle again.
If you're new to this podcast, welcome. If you're an old friend, hey, how you doing?
If you're new to school.
Yeah, if you're new in school, if you're the new kid, we're not going to make you stand up in front of the classroom and introduce yourself, but just know that the most important introduction that I could do is this gentleman that I do the podcast with. He is the Hall to my Oates and the David Crosby to my Kevin Nash, and we don't even need Steele. Was
his name really Kevin Nash?
No, that's a wrestler.
Yeah, I know, that's why I asked you that.
I don't think it was. That sweet, sweet man that asked that brilliant question is my partner, Chris.
Hey, everybody. Not a tough name for a enforcement agency.
Or Pinkertons?
Yeah. I think maybe that's why before we kind of started looking into this, I looked at it and it was always kind of, I played Red Dead Redemption.
Yep.
I had heard about the Pinkertons beforehand. Just if you watch any Westerns or anything like that, the Pinkertons were essentially, you had your marshals and everything. You had your Wyatt Earp. You had the marshal. And then you also had the Pinkertons, and they always seemed like the Pinkertons, just like in real life, were almost like more clandestine and not secret agent-y, but like they seemed like feds, like what you would think of. They seemed like the guys in suits showing up and being like, we have some questions.
Except not bound to the rules of law.
Correct. Not, yeah, exactly. No, they didn't have any of those pesky government restrictions, essentially.
Well, what I think I saw that there's like Pinkerton characters in James Bond novels.
There's probably Pinkerton-esque.
Like American agents.
Yeah, but at the time the James Bond novels were written, Ian Fleming, they still had the, it was the OSS office that had moved into MI6. They had more of a CIA type American agency at that point, but who was the precursor to all that?
The Pinkertons, baby. So, yeah, before we get into it, as we always hit you guys up for these things, to rate, review, subscribe, 5 stars, please. That just basically broadens our reach so we can kind of get new stuff done. We have a lot of ideas to really shift this thing up into gear. YouTube as well. We are up on YouTube. No video format. It's just going to be the clip picture for the podcast, but all of our audio and everything is up there with the hope that we can turn this into a video podcast and start traveling to some places, some historical places, and get stoned and visit some fun things to video and record.
All right, guys. Well, with that, we are jumping into, well, is there a 2 in the Pinkertons, 1 in the Stinkertons? Is that a thing?
Pinkerton and the Stinkerton?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, they definitely did that to a lot of people, and we're about to find out how. So where does this thing start?
Some shit that I really just never realized. And this is sort of one of those things I think where if you just never, like if it never comes across your mind as something to think about, you never really care about the answer. But policing in like the 1800s was sort of non-existent. Like there certainly was policing done in the United States or the Americas, the colonies, really, what have you, in early America. But it takes a lot of its nods from exactly where we came from, exactly from kind of the England common law or the English common law system.
Constables.
Yep.
What were they during the Jack the Ripper episode? It was
Billy Club.
No. The name of the police.
I thought it was Constable.
Was it constables? Okay.
But,
PC, police constable.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Basically, that's akin to what I would recognize is like beat cops. There wasn't really anything specialty. It was just people that were hired to kind of like through just presence, try to make sure people kind of stayed within the bounds of the law.
And just kind of keep the peace, which yeah. is exactly what they should be doing.
A fight breaks out, something happens in a bar brawl, the paddy wagon pulls up and you just have guys getting out, and everyone with their whistles and everything, and just gets everybody into the back of the fucking paddy wagon, and then they go back to jail.
And they believed a lot of social obligation too, as far as if you see something, say something, just sort of different ways to police what's going on in the public, just themselves as private citizens, to call out the people that are causing issues. If somebody gets something stolen from them, you look around to try to find out who it was. And that was sort of how it went from a very long time in the colonies.
Well, if you think about it, even after kind of the migration west, you know, I'm not saying that Westerns or anything like that are accurate, but they do base some of that stuff in historical fact. You would go into town, and in a town, you would just have one, you'd have the town sheriff. Mm-hmm. And then maybe he had a deputy.
A jailer, somebody to watch the prison other person. Cell, the jail cell.
But if something went down, you were having to round up people that you thought were trustworthy. And there was just one guy or two guys responsible for essentially like law enforcement and protection of entire towns.
Yeah. And then whoever they could round up that was sober enough to shoot straight.
Mm-hmm.
Shockingly enough, the first kind of colonies, there was something developed called the Watchmen. And the Watchmen were the first public police force in North America, formed in Boston in 1631. And then they were formed in New Amsterdam in 1647. As we all know, New Amsterdam turns into New York eventually. So the colony times, 1631, 1647, they weren't really paid a salary. They were kind of given like a little bit of a, I don't know, it was probably some walking around money, some pocket change, but most of their pay consisted of tips from private citizens who they had helped out.
I see that having a few issues. Just out of the simple fact that if someone had a beef against their neighbor or something else,
yep.
just giving a larger tip and being like, you know, I think this guy might be up to something. If you could just search around, maybe make his life a little more difficult. I see that being a very unbiased, incentive-based type of a role.
Well, and not to mention if you had run across somebody before that you had had to help out and they either stiffed you or didn't give you a real great amount of money, you might be a little less inclined to help them out.
Keeping a ledger. Now, if someone broke into my house and you're looking through, you're like, I see you've tipped me a total of 8 shillings
you
this
said,
last year.
I'll get you next time, bud. Mm-hmm. Is that what you said?
Ooh, it's too bad next time didn't come before this time.
So beyond that, slave patrols in the South were sort of like the first unofficial police force in the United States. When you would have a runaway slave, you would have somebody, a African-American person that's trying to make it to the North, trying to take their own freedom, as it were. These slave patrols would go around and flip houses, whatever they could, to try to find the person that they were looking for. 1779, Thomas Jefferson created something called the Chair of Law and Police at William and Mary College. His belief, along with some of the others to create it, was that the police are meant to keep the peace, and justice or law is meant to punish the disorder. So essentially, the police are the ones that are supposed to keep society running. And if somebody steps outside of those bounds, laws and the justice system are supposed to punish the disorder that happens.
Separation of the police and the courts.
Which, to me, sounds like a very great way to do things.
It's the idealistic way to design it. It's the same way they designed other aspects of the separation of the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial, like all that kind of mm-hmm. stuff, yeah.
And some of those things, I think, go hand in hand. I've always sort of, we always hear that the American justice system is one of the better justice systems.
Justice system.
Like, yeah. That these things go hand in hand. And we know that policing isn't perfect. I think that there's a belief that the court systems are pretty good. I don't know, honestly, if I've ever really seen the American court system work in a perfect manner all the time. They always get shit wrong. And we're going to see a lot in some of these court cases that go through with the Pinkertons that the justice system is only as good as the people that are running it.
That's what I'm saying. It's human.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. And humans, if we've learned anything, it's that humans are extremely both complicated and, infallible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fallible individuals.
Wait, infallible or fallible?
Infallible means that you can't be failed, right?
Okay, let's go fallible then.
kind of to get close to where we are going to start, New York, now New York instead of New Amsterdam, established the first police department in New York. 1844, this was full pay. So these people are actually, I don't know if it was full pay, but full-time it was definitely.
Huh? You know how full-time fuzz.
Yeah. I don't know if it was like a full salaried position, but I know that they were getting paid a livable wage. Followed by New Orleans and Cincinnati in 1852. And in the late 1850s, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Baltimore followed with a policing trend, starting their own departments. Why would Chicago be important in this story?
I'll think about that, but going back just a little bit, it makes sense that once you start to get a larger population, mm-hmm. you need something to control and enforce the law because, again, as soon as that village isn't working together to make sure that their survival needs are met, when there's a little bit of free time and everything, and you start to get more people there, you're going to attract an element that's going to try to go ahead and break the law or steal from those people. So it's something you really don't think about. But yes, of course, the major metropolitan areas are going to go and develop a system of this first. I would imagine Chicago would have to have, well, it's a growing city. It's a metropolitan city. I don't know if it's because it's some type of port that comes in like from Canada. It's
huge.
Oh, absolutely. Is that what it came? Is that what it is for?
Chicago was tiny around this time, but being a port city, you're going to have all sorts of commerce coming in through the Great Lakes. It's the center of the country, but it's also kind of leaning towards the West. Because at that point in time, the West was literally like Missouri. It was the Midwest was the Wild West at that point in time. But in order to come through a port city like that, Chicago actually right around then wasn't that big. There was like maybe, I want to say I heard numbers between like 5,000 and 10,000 people.
That's still enough people that there needs to be people enforcing because there's going to be all walks of life.
The population densities, we kind of know crime seems to go hand in hand with population densities that are heavier.
You have a place where there's a concentration of both wealth and goods. That's the places that are going to get robbed. Yeah.
I was kind of surprised that Cincinnati made that list. Cincinnati doesn't really jump out as like a big city to me, but I'm sure it has to be, right?
Birthplace of Skyline Chili, man.
Yeah. But you'd think when you say Ohio big cities, it would probably be Cleveland first every time, right?
I don't know which one was created first. It's all based on commerce routes, man. If true. Cincinnati, I'm not sure. I heard a fact that every AFC East team is, or maybe AFC North, is on the water. Their stadium is on the water. Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and Baltimore, all on rivers. Their stadiums.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to get to on that is that if the river route going through Cincinnati was much more widely used than that going through Cleveland, it would stand to reason that that Cincinnati would essentially be the more developed and faster developing city.
That makes a lot of sense. So yeah, getting back to Chicago, we are going to jump across the pond all the way over to Glasgow, Scotland. Alan Pinkerton, born August 21st, 1819 in Glasgow, Scotland, in an area called the Gorbals. The Gorbals were like the bad part of Glasgow at this time.
I was going to try to say that with a Scottish accent, but I'm trying to think of how it's going to sound in my head.
It's going to sound Irish.
Gorbals.
Gorbals.
Yeah.
But growing up in an environment where you see a lot of crime, I'm sure that young Alan's mind was probably changed just in the area that he grew up in, the nature over nurture effect of being able to see what being in a bad area would be. His father, William, there was questions as to whether he was some sort of a jailer. He was involved somehow in a policing style system. His father was killed when Alan was 10 years old. So you immediately have to step up. It was Alan and I believe his older brother. They had to find some way to support their mother at this time when your dad dies at 10 years old. It's just how the world worked back then.
Well, he ends up dropping out of school. And again, history like this that you have to take with a grain of salt is that most of this stuff, when it comes to these details of their childhood, before there's people that can corroborate the stories of a differing perspective.
Yeah.
You get a lot of the gaps being filled in. Sure, I'm sure they were able to track back that his father died when he was 10 years old. They said that he was self-educated, a voracious reader, and that part of one of the things. And I don't think the knock, when we get into it, we have a very specific viewpoint on the Pinkertons based on the research we've done, and we're going to get to that and the shady shit. But our takeaway on this was that this was started through more positive or benevolent, not benevolent's not the right word, morally positive goals in mind.
Yeah, I honestly think that Alan stumbled into this whole Pinkerton Detective Agency, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, because I don't think that this was ever his goal in life.
Atheist, that's what I was getting to.
Oh, atheist.
In a roundabout way. Yeah. I was just like, hey, good on you, buddy.
he really had no religious bent to anything. Young Alan became something called a Cooper. And a Cooper is a barrel maker. Mm-hmm. Didn't realize that that would be the name. I figured barrel maker would be probably what you would call that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Maybe Coopers do some different things. Hooper would make even more sense to me, to build the metal hoops around the barrels. But
maybe that's what it was. The Cooper put it together and the Hooper built the rings.
Okay. Working in unison.
Great show. Hanging with Mr. Cooper. It could be the early life story of Alan Pinkerton.
But Alan, as a Cooper, was active in something called the Chartist Movement. The Chartist Movement was sort of like a power to the people, power to the worker movement that was happening in Scotland. At this time, Scotland is a part of Great Britain. They are being bullied around by the Big Brother of England. And as this Chartist Movement is moving towards trying to create unions and trying to give more power to the worker, they ran afoul of England pretty quick. He had found out that his name was on an arrest report that was coming down, so he was going to be pinched along with these other Chartist leaders that he had already seen go down and be arrested for things, and he decided that it was time to get out of Scotland. So when they got hot, he left Scotland with his wife Joan. They boarded a ship that was bound for America in 1842.
They come from all around the world. They're coming to America.
Well,
today.
In a way, he was coming to America, but they ended up running aground in Nova Scotia. So the boat.
Close enough.
Yeah, close, yeah. The boat that they were coming over in, that he was actually doing Cooper work for on the boat to help pay for some of their fares and to kind of get a little money in his pocket before they made ground.
Is anyone a Cooper? Is anyone a Cooper? I just happened to be so. We need your help.
Is that what it was for boats back then? Was instead of, is there a doctor in the house? It's, is there a Cooper on the ship? Yeah. But they get to Nova Scotia. They run aground. And they had to leave all of their belongings that they had packed with them on the ship in order to get to a safe location. So all the shit that they were bringing over to start their new life in America just completely went away. As they were in Nova Scotia, he did a little bit more work as a Hooper just to try to Cooper. Get them enough. Or no, you're a Cooper, Hooper. Shit. A Cooper. He had a friend in Chicago that he'd actually grown up in the Gorbals with. And they were going to go stay with him. So finally, they make enough money.
This is the thing that Stav always talks about, is that that's where you determined where you're going to go. You didn't have an idea of what this place was or anything like that. You just knew, you knew a guy that lived in this place called Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then because that guy was there, you would know somebody. And so that's where you would plan on going.
Yeah, and we see it so much today. That's why there's such a Scandinavian influence in places like Minnesota and Wisconsin, because mm-hmm. all the immigrants that came over from there settled in a place that I think probably has a fairly similar climate and somewhere where they could do a lot of the same stuff, so mm-hmm. they would go there. Just like when they were coming over to New York. I think we talked about it a little bit in the Prohibition episode. There's sections of New York that are Little Italy, Little Germany.
Chinatown?
All those,
yeah, exactly, Chinatown. Yeah.
All those places just to be around other like-minded individuals. So he was headed to Chicago to meet up with a friend. They get to Chicago. Once he gets there, they're staying with the friend. He finds a job again as a Cooper at a place called Lil's Brewery and decides that he needs to make more of a life for himself than just being a Cooper in a brewery making barrels.
So he's 23 when he immigrates, right?
1842.
Yes, I believe so.
Born in 1819, yep. So 23.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's not insane to think about. I mean, he was 10 when he essentially dropped out of school to help his family. But 23, you look at how people were 23. You take your wife and you just move to a new country with literally nothing but the – not only nothing but the bags that you can carry with you, but then you lose the bags.
Yeah. So you just got whatever it's in your pockets and whatever your wife can fit in her dress pockets. Hopefully they had dress pockets.
He's just like, honey, if we're really being serious here, you're going to have to ditch all this shit. We got to just strap all these Cooper tools because this is what's going to be our bread and butter.
Yeah. Yeah. So he sets out kind of on his own. They leave Chicago. They move to a place called Dundee, Illinois. I think it was founded by Mick back probably before the Crocodile Dundee series in 1843. And Pinkerton started his own coopering business and by all means was very successful in that business. He also,
you're the only guy in town that could be making barrels.
Yeah, I guess
you
depending
got that
on
barrel monopoly on lockdown.
How big Dundee is, everybody needs barrels back then for some reason or another. I'm sure barrels were probably pretty key back then.
I'm not going to lie to you. Like any receptive, we take for granted just the simple fact of a cardboard box, something that you can just look around. If you order from Amazon, you have just an abundance of cardboard boxes all over your house. But weirdly enough, like mass manufacturing or making of that type of stuff wasn't a thing back then. And if you needed something to keep your vegetables in or like stuff like that from a grains and everything, having a barrel, a good quality barrel, was a must have. And so, yeah, if you had a skill like this, you know, there's still coopers nowadays that make whiskey barrels, wine barrels. That's still a profession, but it's much more niche as far as the market goes. But back then, I mean, it was barrel or bust. Like that's what you were keeping shit in.
Yeah. We didn't have plastic.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have just a plastic bucket or anything like that. I wonder if people were more healthy back then. Like the worst they had to worry about was catching maybe like a stray sliver. Now we have to hear about like microplastics in our water and shit. So, one thing that changed Alan's life for, I would say, the better. I mean, he was probably making a pretty decent living being a cooper. I think his wife said at this point in time, this is like the best years of their life. But in 1847, Alan was foraging out for his own wood. So he didn't even want to go to the middleman to get his wood. He wanted to go source this good Dundee, Illinois pine or whatever the hell he was making the barrels out of. He ends up landing on this island that he had gotten some wood from before, and he had seen a fire that looked like it was pretty recent. He'd never seen anything like that before. So he's like, God, I wonder what they're doing. I should probably stake this place out and see what's going on.
As a cooper naturally would.
Yeah, yep. As a cooper's natural instinct is to be like, I wonder what's going on out here. Is somebody moving in on my barrel territory?
That's right, stealing the wood? I'm going to scare off these goddamn barrel thieves.
So this was also at a time back before we had like solid banks where we had.
I have questions about this part. Get to what he found out they were doing so I can ask my question.
So he would stay out there during the day, would never see anything, ended up going into night surveillance one night, and he picks up this counterfeiting ring that's going out to this island to create what was called Wildcat Bucks.
When I first heard he came upon a counterfeit ring, and because he was a cooper, I thought it was a
fake barrels.
I thought it was fake fucking barrels. I was like, oh my God, his barrels are like the official ones, and these guys are out in the woods making these cheap fucking knockoffs. No wonder he's pissed off. And then I read again, I was like, because you think back then, especially like if someone is still making barrels as a business and everything, you're like, yeah, stuff probably wasn't given in paper monetary type stuff. It was like, I have these turnips for one of your barrels. He's like, fucking deal.
Pretty big trading
but
economy.
The fact that there's already a counterfeit operation like out in the woods making these things called, what'd you call them, wildcat bucks?
Yeah.
It's like a shrewd buck.
Oh, well, each of these banks that people would use all kind of created their own currency. So I don't know what, if it was just like a one for one trade off for each one of these currencies.
Yeah.
But these currencies were very, very easy to counterfeit, probably because they were very basic. We're talking about a time when the printing press to make money probably wasn't the most high-tech item.
Correct, but it's even more impressive to me because there were obviously presses needing to be used to make this money. So these guys out in the fucking woods or wherever they were have the ability to make or simulate these presses, any dyes that they had to use, the printing of the inks on it and everything.
I'm pretty sure it was just ink. I don't think it was a lot of dye.
Okay. I'm just saying it seems very like elaborate. Like we think of it nowadays, it's like everyone has access to a fucking laptop or a scanner or any of that kind of shit or a printer.
Even Frank Abagnale style where he's going to these auctions and buying these old money printers.
Yeah, exactly. But to do that back then, it was even like, oh shit, like that's kind of crazy.
These are iPod Gen 1
money
printers.
So Detective Pinkerton here decides that he's going to take down this counterfeit operation.
Well, what do you do? You go tell the police, and then the police show up out there and arrest him, right?
Yeah, you don't jump in there with your hammer and, like, fucking chisel or whatever and be like, freeze, motherfuckers!
Well, so he goes to this guy. He was the sheriff in Dearborn. His name, or his sheriff, or his name was Sheriff Luther Dearborn. I'm sure he was the sheriff in Dundee. He's like, hey man, there's some guys out here that are running this counterfeiting operation. You should probably go look into it.
Do you think he knew it was a counterfeit operation? Because you would have to, like, very specifically go in there and find out. You can't notice that from a distance. You just see him loading shit onto a wagon or whatnot. Yeah. You would have to go in and look and know what you were looking at. And I'm not saying he didn't know it was something nefarious or illegal. What I think it's saying is that he went into town, told the sheriff that there were these guys out in the woods being kind of shady and doing all this kind of stuff. The sheriff took some guys out there and then found out what it was. But then he still gets credit. They don't say he saw some nefarious guys and turned them in and it busted a counterfeit operation. You make it sound like he busted a counterfeit operation.
He did.
I know, but I don't think he knew it was a counterfeit operation. To have that...
Well, yeah, just to shore that up, when he goes to Dearborn and he tells him what he saw out there, Dearborn gets like one other policeman, and then he's like, hey, are you any good with a gun? And Pinkerton's like, why? Guy goes, well,
I'll learn on the way.
Yeah, I'm going to need you to come out with us and help us bust these guys. So Pinkerton himself, just a normal average Cooper citizen, is being taken out by a sheriff.
Standard run-of-the-mill Cooper.
Yeah.
Salt of the earth.
And one other deputy, and he ends up helping them in the apprehension of these criminals. Like, that was how far policing was behind the trend back then, was if you reported something, there was a great chance you were going to be asked to help them bust them.
So you're reporting this. Yes, I am. I'm going to need to deputize you. What for? Well, I mean, we kind of run a situation, a policy where if you report it, you have to come out and help make the arrest. I didn't make the rules.
Yeah.
Here's your gun. Point this end where you want to kill something.
Well, I'm sure once they got there, he was probably like, what is all this shit? What are they doing out here? What are they making? The guy's like, you busted a counterfeiter ring.
That's exactly what it was.
So yeah, after that happens, his story spreads around town pretty fast. He's propositioned by a grocery store owner to help him figure out some counterfeit bills that have been coming through the grocery store. And his detective skills far outweigh, I guess, maybe his need to make barrels. Because once that happens, he takes a job as a deputy in Dundee.
I feel like this is a situation where people were like, he got his name in the paper, whatever the local town publication was.
Yeah.
This guy busted it. I'm not saying he's not a perceptive guy or anything like that, but to be like that, these people after this story spreads and being like, he's obviously a fantastic detective because he saw a campfire and followed it to a building and then ended up busting this counterfeit ring. I think it's just that no one had really heard of someone doing this, or this was spun in a way to make it seem like it was his, you know, skills of deduction, or, you know, it was just primarily based on that. It's just funny to me that it's like, this is an Air Bud situation. They dumb see luck. The dog make one fucking basket and all of a sudden he's on the team. There's no concern with if this dog can dribble, if this dog, you know, can come in as a sixth man off the bench and still contribute to the team. It's just like, we saw that dog make a free throw and we're in such dire need. You're a detective now.
Get him a jersey.
Yeah, no shit.
So Pinkerton leaves his coopering business. Right after that happens, he's actually offered a detective job in Chicago that we were just talking about earlier with the police force in 1849, and he becomes the first detective in the city of Chicago.
I don't understand this. It's so fast. Like, what is it, just that there's an outcry in Chicago? It's like, you know, someone needs to be able to, the crime solve rate at this point had to be just fucking atrocious. You sent me that text about, like, you said man-made crime essentially back, you know, 100 years ago had to be so fucking easy, which, yeah, it was. If you weren't a complete moron, if you had any common sense, I think you could get away with almost anything.
Well, and it's so much, just like we were talking about in Jack the Ripper episode, unless they catch you with the murder weapon in your hand, either leaving or committing the act, you could probably get away pretty easily.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't take a whole lot. There was no, What does he say in Super Troopers? If the criminal had committed the crime and then ejaculated everywhere, we might have had a pretty good chance to find him.
Yeah.
Like, this wasn't a situation where you had any sort of blood. He actually later on starts to use fingerprinting, which seems like a pretty cool adaptation to the whole detective thing.
Maybe he is just that naturally, like, curious, and he has a deductive mind. He read a whole bunch, so maybe he's really good about putting two and two together. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and kind of retract and maybe say that he didn't deserve to rise this fast. There might be a reason for it, because if he's an atheist, he's obviously got some common sense. He doesn't believe in, like, he's going after facts. I think it's kind of what it sounds like.
Yeah, and I will give him a point. There was a time that he worked for the United States Postal Service. And when he went into the Postal Service, he was called in because there were concerns that in a mail sorting plant, there were some things that were being stolen and not delivered. He sat up on a catwalk and watched the way that they were sending out mail. And basically what would happen would be he was standing watching the people down below. They would dump mail onto a conveyor belt or whatever the fuck they had that looked like a conveyor belt back then. And there would be somebody that would be grabbing the letters and flipping them face up so you could see the address on them. Mm-hmm. And he figured this was probably where something was going on. So one day he's up there watching and he sees this guy that's working down on the floor. And as he's picking them up, he feels like that's where something is going wrong. So he watches this guy, watches him pick an envelope up, feel it for a little bit, set it on the belt, pick another one up, set it on the belt after he felt it, pick another one up. He felt it, and he must have felt something big in there because he slipped it into his apron and then just continued on throughout his day. So he believed that as...
Obviously, they don't know this guy's watching him.
No.
Okay.
No, he's just up there hanging out. But
no one mind him. He's a structural engineer. Just making sure everything's on the up and up up here.
Well, and Pinkerton figured, hey, if he's feeling these, I wonder if he's feeling for any sort of thicker envelopes that could have cash or anything like that in them. Yeah. So he does what anybody else would do, and he makes up a few dummy letters that are packed thicker than the rest of them and puts them on the conveyor belt and then watches for what this guy does. He sees one of his letters come through. He sees him pick it up, feel it, feels that it's thicker, slides it into his apron. Next day, the police show up at this dude's house and find just tons of mail that had been stolen. There was a fair amount of money in there. I want to say it was a couple $1,000s. They end up finding out that his brother also works at another post office, and they go to find him. They do the exact same thing with him. They see that he's doing the same thing. They go to his house. They're looking. They cannot find anything. They just don't have the evidence to convict the brother. Pinkerton's looking around the house, and he looks over at one of the picture frames, and he goes, pull down that picture frame. They pull down the picture frame, and on the back of the picture, there's a bunch of money shoved right behind the frame. I don't know if this is just creative liberty that he took when this story gets told.
Revisionist history or artist embellishment and everything like that.
But there is documented proof that he did help the Postal Service with...
Yeah, this sounds like the kind of stuff you see on the fucking Mentalist or whatever, like fucking Psych or whatever it was. It's like that picture is sitting slightly, like there's level pictures all over the place. It was probably because no one had fucking pictures, and he was like, huh, I've never seen a picture in a frame just in this house before.
Yeah.
Some officer knocked it off the wall and it came forward and there was money on it. And he's like, I'm going to actually say that I knew that that was there.
This is like those detective games where they show you the room and they're like, what looks out of place?
Yes.
He just happened to find a picture. But it helped get him a detective job in Chicago, which, again, a very small city at that point, but they needed a detective, and he was the first detective in Chicago. Didn't stick around very long. That was 1849. 1850, him and an attorney named Ed Rutger created the Northwestern Police Agency, which would become the Pinkerton and Company, which would then finally, in its final iteration, become the Pinkerton National Detective Agency.
Really missed opportunity here to have Rutger be the front man of this thing. You could have had Rutger's Fuckers. There were so many possibilities of different naming here on this. That's Rutger also sounds much more threatening and serious.
Oh, yeah.
What are we going to call this? We're going to call it the Pinkerton Agency.
It definitely doesn't have the ring to it. For what he lacked in name, he created a pretty sweet logo. The logo was an eye with the phrase, "We never sleep," below it. The eye is very ominous. It's used so much imagery. The people that believe in, like, the Illuminati and shit like that, like, it's a very similar eye. But yeah, "We never sleep's a pretty hard...
Well, the origin of that, they didn't make that immediately. The origin of how that, I think, became their logo, as they say, is that... her name was Kate something.
We'll get to her.
But anyway, she was one of the ones writing.
Kate Warren.
Yes. So Kate Warren was one of the people writing with Lincoln.
First female detective ever.
Yes. And it makes perfect sense why he would want, because if you're running an intelligence gathering or detective agency, you can't just, and you're trying to gather information where there's it's a situation where there's nothing but women there. You can't have a man go in there and just be like, "Don't mind me, go about your business." He understood that you had, and he demonstrates this, you know, along in his career. He has to have people that blend into and can gather information because, again, they're fucking undercover. But so the story is that Kate Warren,
yep,
she was accompanying Lincoln on his train, and there was some suspicion about something possibly going down. And so she actually stayed up like a total of like 36 to like 40 hours or something the entire ride. And so that's where it came through with the open eye and "We never sleep."
This is Teddy Roosevelt taking those criminals back that robbed that boat and mm-hmm. not sleeping while he has them the entire time. Yeah. Like, you got to stay awake to stay vigilant. They came up on a big boon, because like we said earlier, this was the Wild West, basically. They were on the edge of the Wild West, sitting in Chicago. Expansion into the West made rail transport a big business.
That would have been like gateway to the West.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been the largest hub, essentially, for anything going into the West, because you have all the trade coming into Chicago, and you're getting all those goods out, you know, if you're taking them south. Even in situations where stuff's coming in from Canada, that's even also going east as well mm-hmm. to New York and all those areas.
Well, and what, St. Louis has the St. Louis Arch that's called the Gateway to the West.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, we're pretty far away from the West in Missouri, but that was just the Gateway to the West.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, these trains made transport out west, back east, really big business. And trains were left pretty vulnerable because they were just easy to rob. They didn't move very quickly back then. There usually wasn't any sort of security on them, and that's where the Pinkertons filled this niche. Also, they were having issues with theft, because if you have, is it the conductor that takes the money and hands out the tickets?
No, the conductor is the guy driving the train pulls and everything. I don't know what the name of the guy
is. Well, yeah. Whoever was letting people on the train, if you had 100 people come on the train that day and you needed to make a little extra money and you take 100 fares and then they ask you how many people are on the train and you say 90, you can pocket 10 fares and probably get away with it.
You're the one doing the counting.
Yeah.
So they're not going to be like, they're going to look at 90 people and be like, eh, yeah.
They're not counting them coming on, getting off, anything like that. So the Pinkertons ran security, which, again, just led into something bigger than that.
Well, this was, like you're saying, back in the days where train robberies, being like gangs riding up on horses and everything of outlaws riding into trains, where you get the image of the guys robbing the car and then running along the top of the train with the money sacks and everything. This is where this kind of stuff is actually happening. This is the days of fucking the Wild Gang, the Wild Bunch with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Yes, real people. This is the days of the Jesse James or Jesse
James gang.
Jesse James gang.
The Reno gang. We'll talk about most of these guys. But one of the big ends, and again, this is what I'm talking about. Everything just keeps leading into the next. There's a gentleman named George McClellan. Pretty important guy from the Civil War episode. He was the VP of the Central Illinois Railroad. The attorney for the Central Illinois Railroad. None other than Abraham Lincoln himself. So you have the Pinkertons working for the Central Illinois Railroad, and since he's running security, he knows McClellan, he's met Abraham Lincoln at this point, he's building up these relationships that would become so, so important during the Civil War.
It's like, your fucking lawyer is skinny as fuck.
Why does he always wear that hat?
Where'd you get this lanky motherfucker at?
How do you get him on trains? He's like the tallest person in Illinois. What's happening?
Well, he loses the hat, and then he comes down a foot and a half.
He was also, again, another feather in his cap, staunch abolitionist. He gave a lot of his personal and financial support to John Brown and Frederick Douglass. he was actually a stop on the Underground Railroad.
Yeah, his house in Chicago. The area outside. I think it was still in Dundee. It might have still been that area, but yeah.
They would use his cabin as like one of the last stops before they could get African Americans into Canada. So very cool that he would care that much about a cause that really, I mean, being an abolitionist, you had to, a white abolitionist, the cause wasn't just for you. It was for other people, and it was for equality. Their first really, really big job was they ended up running security for Lincoln as he toured. It was called the Whistle Stop Tour from Illinois to D.C. For his inauguration. This was a pretty big deal because we didn't have a Secret Service at this point. These guys were the precursor to the Secret Service, and the Secret Service didn't start till 3 months after Lincoln was assassinated.
It's so crazy we didn't have more presidential assassinations. Yeah. Like leading up to this point, like
Lincoln was the 16th president?
I believe so. And then after this is the formation, you know, 3 months after this is the formation of the actual like protection detail, the Secret Service. But was it a combination of just like, you know, America was new, everyone was rah, 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 and then an unavailability of a weapon that people couldn't notice? It wasn't like you had like, you know, maybe pistols, even the black powder ones were a lot rarer. But like, if you see someone walking into like where the president's going to be speaking, carrying his fucking musket, you're going to be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. But just the fact that like no other presidents, how easy would it have been after the Revolutionary War for the British just to keep fucking with us to be like, yeah, we're just going to keep sending people over to kill your presidents.
We didn't like that guy.
But eventually it would have turned right back around. We would have sent people over there that still looked like and spoke like them to just to kill the king.
They didn't want that smoke a second time. Yeah. They got it the first time during the Revolutionary War.
Our focus is Australia now. Yeah. We're focusing on Australia now.
We made that perfectly clear. Australia is the new destination for us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as they're running this security for these whistle stop rallies, they start to get a little bit concerned. There's a stop in Baltimore, part of Maryland, and Maryland is still a slave state. This is after the Civil War already sort of started. There was already secession that was happening. Maryland hadn't quite yet seceded, but at the same time, they were kind of like right on the border of doing it. For some reason, Pinkerton believed that this was going to be something dangerous, so he sent, just like you were talking about, Kate Warren and four other detectives into some bars and hotels in Baltimore. They heard of this plot from some Southern sympathizers that when they stopped in Baltimore, that they were going to basically cause a distraction that would bring security away from Lincoln, and then they were going to assassinate Lincoln in Baltimore. Lincoln didn't exactly go along with this. He's like, I don't know about that. But then he actually got a memorandum from, it was like his Secretary of War's brother or something like that, that also had a very similar plot. Mm-hmm. So
once, like against him?
Yeah. Okay. Once Lincoln heard it twice, he's like, all right, we'll probably.
Oh, this is a thing. They're doing this. And again, take this with a grain of salt because this is just known as the, and I'm quoting, the Baltimore plot.
Yeah.
There's talk on both sides of this thing, whether this was something that, you know, he might have thought this was going to happen without really any evidence, and then just been like, regardless of how this works out, if I skip this and he gets there safely, I'll say it was because of me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that I was just being on the cautious side. So I think this is a combination of embellishment, just to put like another feather in the cap. And to kind of bring a little bit more recognition to maybe the Pinkerton name.
Dude, it's great PR.
Fantastic.
It's the best PR that you can get, that you maybe thwarted a plot that was going to kill the president.
I'm not going to lie to you. Anytime Lincoln was getting around somewhere safely, there was a consistent plot during the entirety of the Civil War to kill Lincoln. So avoiding this one is just, he's like, well, ours was the Baltimore plot.
Well, knowing what we know now, Lincoln and assassination are pretty intertwined. So I don't think they would have seen that coming, but at the same time, it's also good to be on the right side of history once it happens.
Had Alan been there,
yeah,
never would have happened.
Yeah, this was Marky Mark if he'd have been on the planes during 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
excuse me, allegedly this plot was, they were concerned about two things. They were concerned about the railroads being messed with, being destroyed, that would have to stop the train. Then robbers and assassinators would show up at the train. They would run the train. They'd get a hold of Lincoln.
Maybe Assassins.
Okay, that works too. Assassinator, it was a wrestler.
I'm the Assassinator.
Their other concern was this whistle stop in Baltimore. When he stops to give his speech or anything like that, there could be a potential stabbing, shooting, anything like that.
It just, again, it seems very easy to get to these, to get to any of the guys mm-hmm. before Lincoln and everything, especially when there's a lot of, when it's, the country is basically a fucking pressure cooker.
So, yeah, their plan is he's leaving Philadelphia. They know that he's supposed to be on a train that's going to be taking off. It's going to show up in the morning. There was some weird rule in Baltimore where trains couldn't pass through the city at night, which I don't know if it was like a noise ordinance or something like that. Noise ordinances back then don't seem like they were a thing, but regardless, there was a rule.
Derailing is 50-50.
Yeah.
And so just to make sure.
Oh, okay. So maybe at night if there's a crash, it could be a lot worse. And in the day, that could be it too.
Derailment was 50-50, but yeah.
Yeah. They switched Lincoln's trains. They took him off the train that they thought would be carrying Lincoln, put him on another train. They threw him in an overcoat.
Overcoat and a fake mustache on him.
Yeah.
And then,
dude,
like a taxi cab hat and everything. No. And then Kate, like, sneaks him in. She's like, "Oh, honey, you're so hilarious." He's like, "Yes, yes, I am."
Just the weirdest way to go about it. I don't know.
Does that guy look like, you know, you're not going to hide 6 foot fucking five or 6 foot four, lanky as fuck, Abraham Lincoln. People are going to be like, "Is that Lincoln?" There's like two guys in the country that probably look like him.
Well, and did they think maybe that there was a mole on the train that would spot him, that they had to dress him up? Like, switching trains wasn't enough?
Again, we're sitting here talking about a situation that might not have happened. Exactly how it's been. It could have been something as simple as like, "Oh, hey, this next train, yeah, we're clearing out a whole car, and then it's just going to be Lincoln. No one's going to ask questions. We're going to close all the shades, and no one's going to know shit."
Yeah. So they run up to Baltimore, dark outside at night. What do? You can't tell them to maybe hold up the ordinance for one train. So you cut the engine to the train. You put it in neutral?
In Baltimore?
Outside of Baltimore.
I'm guessing if they had a rule that no trains could come through, then there would be multiple tracks. And there would also be, because trains coming through there, they wouldn't be coming through there on their schedule. They would stay there wherever they were beforehand and not leave till the following, maybe a few hours before sun was up, and time it to where they were getting in. There's, you know, there's a lot of scheduling even at this point. If there's trains, they're going on a certain schedule and being a certain place at a certain time. So it was probably understood, because traveling to Baltimore was not a random, or, you know, it happened all the time. They would have to know that that was something, and then just plan their schedule to be sending in the trains once it was light.
Well, this is where the story gets interesting, because as they stop outside of Baltimore, they put the train in neutral, whatever they have to do to keep it rolling. They then attach horses to the front of the train, and the horses pull the train through the city of Baltimore at night to get around the trains running.
Is Lincoln on this?
Yeah.
This
one? Yep.
Okay, so they still went through. So it's the same train then?
No, there was his train that he was going to get on in Philadelphia or wherever they were leaving out of Pennsylvania. He jumped on another train. So this wasn't the presidential train that was coming through. It was a secondary train.
But he's still on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Why didn't they just skip Baltimore altogether?
I don't know. As far as where train tracks were or anything like that, I'm not sure.
Okay.
But they drug this train all the way through Baltimore till they got to the other side by horse. So, like, just, like I said, they just rolled it through the city at night.
Yeah, it makes sense. The train that he would be riding in would definitely be identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, "Well, if we have to go through here, put him on another train, change the timing of that, probably." Yeah. And then people will just think, "Oh, it's..." First of all, they're not going to hear it going through Baltimore. So if anyone is waiting to hear a train come in or anything like that, that's part of this plot. I can see how a lot of it, to me, seems like someone sitting there being like, "And then what can happen?"
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they end up getting drugged through Baltimore by these horses. I'm sure they were super strong horses to drag a train on tracks.
Putting out a call to all horses.
Morning comes. Lincoln's train's supposed to be rolling in. All of a sudden that they get news that Lincoln's on the other side of Baltimore headed to D.C. So once he gets to D.C., of course, Pinkerton can come out and be like, "Hey,
were you guys on? We were on Chicago time. We got in a little early."
Gotcha.
No one was here. We were just like, he gave his speech, loaded back up, and we're out.
You guys missed it. It was 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
So yeah, they successfully deliver Lincoln to DC for his inauguration. and just kind of skipped over maybe something that could have been a plot. I lean more towards on the side of it not being real and being just a great PR stunt. But there again, we also have Lincoln, who did get assassinated eventually. So there is maybe some smoke to the fire.
Regardless of what works out, Lincoln made it there safely. The Pinkertons were involved.
Yeah.
If so facto, the Pinkertons were the reason that he got there safely.
Yeah. It works out really, really well. And as far as that goes, Pinkertons would be very pivotal, or I guess not super pivotal, but the one thing that they did really, really well during the Civil War was Allen was able to snuff out a lot of the Confederate spies that were in DC at the time, which espionage, I think, is something, it's a skill as old as time. It's been around forever.
Deceptive tactics, you know, sabotage, that kind of stuff. You don't think of this aspect of the Civil War. I don't think we talked about this one. I don't think we mentioned the word espionage during the entire Civil War episode. And thinking about it now, how was there not?
Yeah.
Everyone fucking looked alike. If you lived close to the border between the northern and southern states, you fucking talked alike. People were from, you know, you had people from the north that were down in the south and people from the south that were up in the north. There was no guarding the borders or anything like that. So, of course, you're going to have people coming up, maybe even family members, and just pretending to be like, yeah, I'm fighting for the North, of influential families, and them not going and having to be frontline soldiers, but are being made officers or maybe people working within the government or something like that. That could be feeding any and every bit of information about troop numbers, the weapons they're using. But you don't, I never thought about that aspect of fucking Civil War spies. Movie idea. Copyrighted.
Well, and
patent pending.
It can't take that idea now. We copyrighted it. Verbal copyright. But it had to have been such a big deal because, like you say, even something you think about it now, if you met somebody from Maryland, you met somebody from Carolina, you could tell the difference of them between their accents, right?
Yeah, I just had a thought. I just see like a bunch of Confederate soldiers sitting around a fire talking, and a guy comes up in a Confederate outfit and he just sits down and he's like, what are we talking about, guys? Yeah, slavery's good, huh?
It's like the Sonny Cracks the Bell episode.
Yes.
When they show up and they're like, we hear talk of revolution. They're like, yeah, we don't want to be a
revolution
part of it. So they go over to Cricks and they're like, hello.
That's exactly what it is. I just see someone being like, what's up, fellow Confederates? I hear Robert E. Lee is a real great guy.
Yeah. Well, even after Pinkerton worked in D.C. to snuff out these spies, which in and of itself is a very, very cool thing to do and probably took a lot of skill.
Well, again, the head of Union Intelligence, right?
Yeah, okay. Another point for him. He actually goes ahead and mounts a horse and heads down to the South himself with Kate Warren. Kate Warren. And she travels as like this beautiful debutante who was maybe somebody, some rich person's daughter, and she gets in good with a lot of different Civil War or a lot of different Southern families, a lot of different Confederate families.
Yeah, because information, you know, confirmation is so hard to come by at this point. You could be infiltrating someone in the Carolinas and they're like, well, where's your family from? She's like, oh, my family's over in Missouri or something. And then what are those people going to say? Be like, well, do they know these people? Oh, no, we don't know those people. They've, you know, as long as you have answers to some pretty basic questions, there's no way someone could. And especially if you're not trying to get a ton of like sensitive information.
Yeah.
No one's going to pay it any attention, especially if you are trained in some type of spy craft.
Yeah. Well, and that's really what this was. This was the first time that we ever saw people, excuse me, or law enforcement agents, like, going undercover. This was a very new tactic. Allen himself traveled as Major E.J. Allen. I just put it together, Allen and Allen. That kind of makes sense. Except for A-L-L-A-N, like his name is.
It's very
A-L-L-E-N. But at the same time, he's rolling around as a major. That is sort of in and of itself, just like you were talking about. There were so many people and so many generals and majors and members of the military in the South. You couldn't possibly know everybody. All you need to do is pick up three or four different things, and you could roll into a brigade and talk shit to them.
You just needed a letter. that looked official that was coming from Commander that they had never heard of, and that was signed by somebody that they didn't know if that looked like their signature, but it, maybe if it had a seal on it, you had to get it based. And again, you're not high enough. You're a major, so you're privy to some information, but you're not. So, you know, as you get higher up the ranks, you know, in these wars and everything, there's fewer and fewer generals and those kind of guys. Major might have been that sweet spot of, like, being able to have authority over getting information, but not high enough to have it be, like, questioned at every turn or, like, I've never heard about you. And they're obviously, you know, unless he's just going in here fucking half-cocked, which it might have worked out. I don't know how many missions this guy went on. Had he gone on one mission, he could say that, yes, he went undercover in the South.
Well, the Pinkertons went deep enough, though. The guy whose name you Googled beforehand.
There were several. Go ahead.
The African-American gentleman.
Oh, yeah.
So, as Major E.J. Allen is traveling through the South, he is going down there with many more Pinkertons, and they're kind of infiltrating the Confederate Army from all different points. And just
John Scobell.
Yeah, John Scobell.
Former slave and been well-educated before being freed, recruited in 1861. He went on a series of missions posing as a variety of different people, from servants and cooks to laborers. Nice.
So that's even, yeah, shout out to him. That's pretty fucking brave to go back to the South after being a freed slave.
No shit.
Yeah, that's a scary thought. But that was the level that they were going in with, was they were bringing African Americans down undercover as servants, that they are talking to other servants at these parties and different things like that. They're getting information from all over the place. Unfortunately, it didn't do them much good, because they said the biggest issue with Allen and the Pinkertons being down there was a lot of the information that they would get would be like troop sizes and troop movements. And they were often very, very wrong.
They were often conflated to much higher numbers, which, weirdly enough, you'd be like, well, what's that going to do if you're saying they have more numbers? So this is also why I kind of lean toward embellishment. If he had a natural tendency to embellish, even in wartime and everything.
Not the time to embellish.
Exactly. And I don't know if he was just doing it in his mind to be like, well, I want to make sure our guys have enough troops to even beat this amount. But what that would do, essentially, and there's a specific, I can't remember what the commander's name was that was with the Union Army. He ended up getting beat in a couple battles because of the information being provided by Pinkerton, is that he was like, well, shit, I only have 15,000 troops. They have 25,000 troops. I'm going to have to go ahead and just do a siege, or just like fight from defensive positions, when if you know that they're only 15,000, you can know you have a lot more, essentially, like freedom of your methodology and how your strategy.
Yeah.
Basically, you're like, oh, I can just meet them and I can split my forces this way, this many people here, this many people here. If you're fighting against a much larger, you have to plan just to keep your, you're not really fighting on the attack. You're not going on offensives. You're just in a holding pattern.
You need to know how many people you need to send out on one of your flanks to try to encircle them. Mm-hmm. I believe the guy you were talking about that he was running with was General George McClellan, the man that he met on the railroads in central Illinois where he met Abe Lincoln. Because I believe McClellan led, oh God, it was one of the bigger.
McClellan ended up taking the blame for it.
Yeah.
Is what it's known. If you're reading into, and I don't know if we talked about him in depth, I can't remember during that episode. Oh, but I just know that if it comes down to it, what we discussed when the Union was just fucking cycling through trying to get guys in the command, it would make sense that if you were the one losing the battle, it would fall on you.
Army of Potomac, I believe,
is what it was. Yes, yes. Yep.
So, yeah, even though they were doing some good work, they were also doing some very sloppy work. When you're getting troop numbers and troop movements from a bunch of drunk guys in a bar, like we talked about, he was able to slip in as a major in the Confederate Army. So who are you talking to that's going to have really accurate numbers?
And who knows if you're even going into these camps?
Yeah.
Like during, like when they're getting ready to do battle and stuff, you're probably going into like a town, and because soldiers see a major coming in due to your rank or whatever outfit you're wearing or anything like that, they're just more likely to provide the information like, soldier, I just rolled into town. I'm going to need to know everything about where we're set up. That makes more sense to me. But yeah, it'd be interesting to know if the information ended up balancing itself off out between pros and cons, but most of it seems to be more so that it was bad intelligence.
Well, and the bad intelligence, I don't think really outweighs being able to root out those spies in DC, because that's true. Where
who knows how much damage those guys could have done. But again, it's hard to, like, if it was embellishments here, it's easier to think like there's embellishments throughout.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than just be like, no, I only talked about this. I only punched up this part.
Well, and after the war, they kind of needed something to do, and their focus drips back to the Wild West, because the Wild West is where the money kind of is for your agency. Detectives are going to be important in every city, but if you're going to go after money, you're going to want to start pairing yourself with a bank, with a train company.
That's what I was going to say. Local law enforcement is tied to the local area. So if a gang came through, was robbing trains, but was traveling through different cities, towns, territories, whatnot, the only time that they could be caught by that local law enforcement is when they're pulling through. And I'm telling you right now, if a gang is just running through and isn't localized, you're probably going to be better off with a small police force or like a town sheriff of being like, I'm not going to start shit. These guys are going to be gone tomorrow. Yeah. It's much easier just to not cause shit, because who knows what they could come in and do to the town. So now you have essentially this agency, the Pinkertons, that can come in and like active pursuit. So this is where you really get the feds coming in.
Yeah. And you're not constricted, like you say, by city limits or anything like that. One of the big things that Pinkerton did, and he really pushed his agents to do, was he had just a ton of mugshots that he had collected from all these different towns that they were going into. Mm-hmm. And so on the back of these mugshots, he would write name, he would write any distinguishing factors or anything like that, as far as like scars, or I don't think there was tattoos back then.
Is this where we get like a classic wanted poster type deal? I think probably a little bit more, not so much like wanted, dead or alive, $5,000, like that kind of stuff, but essentially kind of in a way.
Yeah, it wasn't that. They actually do collect like the most extensive mugshot database in the country at one point, and they're kind of the ones that started building these databases. But he would carry them around to different towns, and he would show the people that were robbed. He'd be like, does it look like this guy, this guy, this guy? Mm. And so once they were able to identify somebody, he could start to put together a string of like, these guys are hitting this area.
A pattern of where they're centrally located at. That makes a ton of sense. Before we get any deeper into this, let's take a bathroom break.
Okay.
Well, hey there, all you sexy historians. How you guys doing?
It is time for
socials.
Where can they find us on Instagram?
If they want to follow us, they can find us at Historically High Pod on Instagram.
That goes the same for Threads as well. You can also find us on Twitter.
Ooh, tell them about Twitter.
Historically High. That's Historically H-I on Twitter.
And if you want to email any of your comments or suggestions, where can they find us at, Adam?
At historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com.
Gmail. All right, and back to the show.
All right, back at it. So we're out west. They're chasing down cattle rustlers and outlaws.
Their first target becomes a group called the Reno Gang. And
pew, pew.
Do you think once they did a successful train robbery, that was how they celebrated? Was they just rode around in their horses?
The biggest old gang on earth? Yeah.
Shot the pistols?
Was it called the Reno Gang because they hung? Was Reno a thing back then? Or family. Is Reno named after him?
Reno family.
Okay. But was Reno named after him?
No, that I don't know, because okay. I think these guys were in Iowa.
Oh, okay.
Either Iowa or Missouri.
Ah, west. Yeah, we're still talking west here. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So this Reno gang kind of cut their teeth robbing trains and courthouses.
Ballsy.
Yeah.
You're going from like, well, this thing's moving and not very well guarded, to like, this is the most stationary fucking guarded thing.
It is kind of a move that seems a little bit scary.
One end of the spectrum to the other.
So John Reno was the first one that was arrested by the Pinkertons in 1867. When he gets arrested, he's supposed to go down for a long time, and much like things worked back then, sometimes you just get broken out of jail and there's not a whole lot that you can do.
Yes.
You're a part of a gang.
Rope around the bars.
Yep.
I'm not saying this out happened, but that's just how I envision it.
Mm-hmm.
They slap the horses on the ass and it pulls the side off of the jail.
There's something to do with the soap bar, I feel like I remember. So, yeah, after John is arrested, Alan Pinkerton's son, William, ends up catching him again in 1868, along with other fellow gang members. And the way that justice worked back in the Wild Wild West was mob mentality, basically.
Prairie justice.
Mm-hmm. So John escapes once. They don't want him to escape again. So there is just a mob that rushes the jailhouse, takes him out of the jailhouse, and lynches him.
Of course. You would think maybe like, hey, we kneecap him first.
Uh-huh.
Because the chances of him, chances are he's going to die from the gangrene, from the kneecapping.
Yeah.
No one's ever going to recover enough. But I guess if you're riding horses the whole time, you can still, you know, maybe, yeah. I could see how they got to that point. We don't want it to happen a second time.
So there's just this understanding that happens throughout their entire dealings with the Reno gang, where they would catch a group of them, they would take them to the local jail and drop them off, and then there would just be vigilante justice that took place after that, and they didn't really give a shit. All they needed to do was put the guy in jail, and if he didn't get back out,
they ride into town and there's literally already a mob assembling. Yeah. And they're like, all right, people, calm down. They literally just, the mob just parts and stays nice, and everyone's just being nice and patient. They take them in, they put them in, like, we're the Pinkertons. We're now turning over custody of these prisoners to you. And then, like, the car dealers in Vegas just brush their hands and walk out. And as they walk out and get on their horses, they just ride away. And you just slowly see the mob start to descend upon the fucking, the deputy and the sheriff are just like, all right, they just part ways and just walk right out.
There's two dudes that open up the swinging doors for them, and they don't just even have lock pistols the behind their backs.
They don't even lock the cells. They're like, why aren't you locking the cells? They're like, you'll see.
You're not going to need this.
Yeah.
So this is kind of how the Reno gang interactions go. They catch them, they put them in jail, they get lynched. Catch them, put them in jail, and get lynched until they just really don't become a threat anymore. One of the biggest things that they ever took on in the Wild West was the James Younger gang. This is where we get the outlaw Jesse James, not the guy that rides motorcycles, but the guy that
broke Sandra Bullock's heart.
Yeah. Dickhead. The James Younger gang was a pretty big deal in Missouri, and they drew the ire to They drew the ire of the Pinkertons after years of just robbing banks. They absolutely loved robbing banks up until June 3rd, 1871, when a bank in Iowa contracted the Pinkertons to be like, hey, you got to come out and do something about the James gang. They just keep hitting these different places. They're taking all of our money. What do we do? We start to try to infiltrate the James gang. We know where they are. We don't really know how we can get to,
they're always on the move. It's trying to find a static force,
mm-hmm.
something that's always moving. So Pinkertons are like, well, due to our experience in the Civil War, I don't know how much that came into it, we find that everybody finds their way back home at some point, or that home is a good place to get information from. So you have the Pinkertons actually put a Pinkerton agent working as a farmhand on the farm that's, and of course, stuff is so spread out at this point, but like on the neighboring farm of the James gang's family, Jesse James' family. And you would think like, oh, they're just going to do surveillance. If the James gang pulls up, you know, they'll notify, then they can come out and chase him down. Not quite how it went down.
No. And it became more personal for the Pinkertons as they kind of kept missing them and chasing them down and couldn't get a hold of them. March 11th, 1874, there was an agent named Joseph Wincher, and Joseph Wincher ended up being found shot dead on the side of the road in Missouri. And after they found him, as they were tracking down the Younger gang that just rolled through that part of town, or through that town, mm-hmm. there's a firefight that ensues. And these were just the Youngers that were there. It wasn't any of the James that were there. And shortly after that, the deputy sheriff, Ed Daniels, got killed, who was traveling with the Pinkertons trying to kill them. Or traveling with the Pinkertons trying to kill the Youngers. There was an agent Lola and John Younger. Both perished in this firefight as well. So you're seeing bodies stack up on the Pinkerton side while the Youngers are losing some men, but still pretty active.
Yeah.
They were kind of told, hey, you need to get off this. We're not going to pay for it anymore. It's just a sunk cost for us. They're so far away from our banks now, we're not in trouble anymore.
Yes, and we probably should have mentioned this. So, yes, the Pinkertons have, like, the Pinkerton Agency and everything like that, but they're almost like a government-funded... They're a government-funded agency at this point. You know, the government is still providing funds and everything like that to like the law enforcement. I don't know how that even worked. I assume they would have to be providing some type of money, but the Pinkertons were essentially the ones, like I said, the feds that they could send over state lines or into these other areas. And so after it keeps coming back of them being like, hey, have you taken care of that James Gang thing? Hey, have you taken care of that James Gang thing? And with him having to report back, no. Well, they killed a bunch of my guys. It gets to the point where they're just like, well, you're not very good at this, are you? So we're not going to give you money to do this.
I don't know if it was necessarily that, or like I say, the people that contracted them initially to get the James Gang was just a bank in Iowa.
I thought it was federal.
I don't think this was federal. Okay. But they're in Iowa.
Sub-government for banks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're in Missouri. They're probably not going to fuck with Iowa anymore. Just drop the case. Pinkerton went ahead and funded chasing them down himself.
Oh, it became a matter of like a point of pride.
Yeah.
He wasn't, this was probably the closest to an L that he was going to get at this point, especially for like a developing agency coming off the war. Mm-hmm. And so for him, this would have been a loss. Had they just stopped and let the James Gang, you know, keep doing what they were doing, he would have had to chalk that up as an L and would have destroyed kind of the reputation of his company. So he's like, no, I'll just pay for this out of pocket. We're going to get these guys. But now that I'm paying out of pocket and I really don't have anyone to answer to in regards to like the bank, now we can kind of take the gloves off.
Yeah, he finds a whole different way to go ahead and take that big fat L. They rolled into Kearney, Missouri on January 25th, 1875. They surrounded the James farm, and when they come up onto the house, there is a firebomb that goes through the window. There's debate whether this was something to try to smoke them out or if it was an actual incendiary device. From what I heard, it was a metal tube that was filled with oil that had a wick in it. So I'm thinking that was probably a bomb. It sounds a lot like a bomb.
Most likely.
But either way, it's tossed in the house. It blew off the right arm of the James boy's mother, and it killed their 9-year-old half-brother. None of the gang was in the house at the time. So this was a very costly mistake that they had made because they didn't catch anybody in the James Gang.
It was a message, man. This was not a mistake. Like
you don't think they thought that?
No, because they found in the government archives in regards to this, they found a letter from Pinkerton in regards to the James Gang, and he said, burn it down. So after he started funding with his own money, he was basically like, nope, I don't have to, you know, I don't have rules anymore.
Yeah.
To get these guys. And no one is, if I break the laws to get these guys, what's anyone going to say? I shouldn't have done it to catch these guys that were, you know, running amok all over Missouri.
Yeah.
And so it was very deliberate that he told them to do this. I think it was regardless if they were there or not. It was to essentially send them a message.
Well, and once news gets out that they killed
innocence.
Yeah, innocent people. The sentiment kind of turns, and it turned on Missouri pretty quickly because Missouri during the Civil War, not a real big fan of the North, also didn't side with the South. They just kind of went ahead and said, we'll go with the North, but we're not going to be involved in anything.
From what I remember, it kind of changed hands back and forth a little bit, and whoever was just in there were just like, you're in control? Cool. And then it got taken over, and they're like, now you're in control? Cool.
Well, and the sentiment was still, I think, very Confederate-leaning in Missouri. These James boys, they had done something kind of interesting, so I didn't ever think of this, but you were paid when you entered the armies.
Yes.
They would show up, they would enter under a false name, false documents, all that kind of stuff. Once they got that first initial bonus to be paid up front, they would just go ahead and bail and take off. So they were just looting the little bits of money that they could from the armies as far as signing up, registering, taking that first bonus and getting out of there. So they were proud Confederate boys that were
ripping off the Confederate system.
Sort of.
Oh no, because at this point they were doing this as the
James Gang.
Okay, so again, the Confederacy has been beaten at this point. So yeah, they're signing up and they're sticking it to the Union by taking the, essentially, what would be the Union or now the Unified United States money, okay.
But as they're doing that, they're kind of these good old Confederate boys in Missouri. They're looked at less as, like, robbers and criminals.
Robin Hoods.
A little bit sort of like
they might not be given all of it to the poor or anything like that, but essentially they're looked at it from enough of the populace as, like, people that are still fighting the fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes
sense. So it kind of put them in as like the dark hero, and the big bad Pinkertons came in and inarguably they did some pretty bad shit. Like, that can't be stated anymore, that they killed a woman or they severed a woman's arm and then killed a child.
It wasn't going to take much to tilt, even if they had, you know, public sentiment was 50-50. As soon as you kill a 9-year-old kid and have no justification, because they weren't like, we thought they were there because the James gang could just come back and be like, we were 50 miles away and we have this entire town that knows that we were there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, public sentiment turns against them really quick after, you know, the civilians are killed. This guy named Franklin Gowan, he, after that, you know, and they're still doing stuff, before I get into that, they're still doing stuff back east. Mm-hmm. It's not like the only activity of the Pinkertons are out west. This is just where it gets the most attention, because I think it's been really romanticized. Because during this period, this doesn't seem like they're doing shady shit up until the firebombing.
Well, and they still have, I believe at this point in time, there was a Pinkerton office in New York and then I think one in Philadelphia.
Okay.
So this is a situation where it's like we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Like, we can go out and fight in the West, but at the same time, we're still kind of handling local business as well.
This is when it takes a turn after this.
Very dark.
And it kind of shows you what they get into. So this guy named Franklin Gowan, I believe he was the owner of coal mines?
Yes,
he was a coal mine owner, and he hired the Pinkertons to essentially investigate this group called the Molly Maguires. They were considered a secret society, like an Irish secret society. As soon as I clicked on their name and I saw information come up, I was like, can't do it. I was hoping it was going to be a small little blurb about the information, and there was a lot to it. I was like, I can't go into these fucking Irish secret societies at this time trying to do research for this. But basically, they were a group, and essentially like a labor union type society in these coal mines. And so this Gowan dude was like, they're starting to kind of cause some trouble. They're starting to ask for things like equal pay or fair pay or, you know, fair working conditions, stuff about safety. I don't want to hear this shit. So he basically hires the Pinkertons to get in and break up this group.
And to get in there, they were fairly concerned about the Molly Maguires because, like Chris kind of alluded to, there's a really big history behind them as far as like coming from Ireland and what they've done over in Ireland. So there was already a little bit of a reputation with the Molly Maguires that they were into some serious shit, robbery, kidnapping, murder, different things like that. And it wasn't necessarily that these Molly Maguires that were in shit,
Pennsylvania, I think.
I think it was Pennsylvania. You're right. In Pennsylvania, that there was a very, very deep Irish influence. And the Irish at this point in time, I don't know if it was just there were so many of them or there was so much disdain for them, but you could actually get away with paying an Irishman less money to do the same mm-hmm. job as an Englishman or somebody like that.
Well, here's the thing, too. Like, the threads aren't hard to connect here, whether they be true or not. They're so close that you can see where the jump was. So this could have literally just been a situation where a group of, because if you're working all together and you're the same nationality, you're trying to get jobs together, you're having to pay them less, just like you said, there's going to be a lot of these people. And if you get these people all talking to each other and start to smell any whiff of unionization, everything, then you're going to want to try to break that up. Well, what better way to break that up than to just be like, hey, I need something bad about the Irish.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, there's this group called the Molly Maguires, because this took place essentially in a workplace, like in the coal mines. The Molly Maguires, yeah, they had been known to do all of this other stuff, like the kidnapping, the robbery, things like that. I really feel like that was more Ireland-based. I think they just kind of used that. And there could have been members that were from the Molly Maguires coming over to try to do something, but I don't think it was that kind of thing. No. They may have had members of it, because they did track, they said some members were, but I don't think all of them were. I just think that, and what we're going to go into here for kind of the remainder of the episode, for the most part, is going to show you that these guys really aren't into asking questions about these jobs. They're just kind of pointed and been like, make this go away.
Yeah. And that's really what they did. Gowan, as you said, he's the president of the Philadelphia and the Reading Railroads in Pennsylvania.
Is it Reading or Reading?
Reading.
Okay.
I've heard that this is a deep point of contention with people because it's R-E-A-D, so it should be Reed, but they call it Redding.
Yeah. R-E-S-B-E-C-T.
That too. Was Aretha Franklin from Philadelphia?
I don't know, maybe.
She could have been. But he was the president of these railroads, the railroads that were working with these coal mines, and so there was a little bit of a dispute to where they needed to go away. He hires the Pinkertons to come down. They send an agent named John McParland in, and he went by
Jimmy McParland.
It was something else. It wasn't McParland. But when I heard it the first time, I was like, why the fuck did they change his last name? He already has an Irish last name, and he's already Irish. Why would they need to change it? I was like, oh, he was undercover.
McPatrick.
It did matter at that point. So Jimmy McParland goes in undercover. He infiltrates the Mollies, and his investigation led, and this was between 1876 and 1878, that these suspects, 20 suspects, were tried and hanged for murder, kidnapping, and other crimes. And it was just based off of the most goofy kind of manufactured, like, there's something here, but we don't know what it is, so we'll just blame the Maguires. Mm-hmm. Like, it really didn't feel great. There was the testimony that they were getting was people that had immunity. And this is also, again, we're talking about a group of Irishmen that are allowed to be paid less than everybody else for doing the same job in these towns.
When are you doing all of this robbery and murder and extortion? Like, if you're doing that, that's what you're doing for your living. Like, you're not, like, working a fucking, what was it, 10-hour workdays? They said something like that was, like, the commonplace. You're not working a 6 to 6 and then being like, okay, I just punched this clock. Now I got to punch into the robbery murder clock.
Yeah.
To me, this, when you look back at it, it's very simple to be like, okay, I'm able to take advantage of all these people. I'm making money hand over fist. They're starting to get grumpy about the fact that I'm paying them less for all this kind of stuff and making demands. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to basically nip this thing in the ass, especially for the fact that not only was it coal mines, but it's railroads. You have all these fucking immigrant people working for you. And if all of a sudden the people working on the railroads are like, did you hear about the guys in the coal mine? They're starting to actually form together to like unionize and starting to try to use that power to possibly like strike or, you know, get better. If that gets word that that was somehow that was successful in any way, shape or form, that's a nightmare scenario for these guys that own these companies. And so what do? You basically make this thing have the most severe type of punishment to it, to where if anybody even just basically because of the, you know, disputes of the manufactured evidence that this happened, you know, that still persists to this day, anyone that hears what the result of this was be like, then that story goes from, hey, they're starting to try to, you know, get together to get better working conditions. It now becomes, you remember those guys that all got together? Yeah, 20 of them were actually tried for murder or whatever and fucking hung.
Yeah.
Any complaints you have about your working conditions or situation at that point kind of go out the window.
Everything has changed at that point to even think about that. They go international. This was something that kind of shocked me in 1872, to backtrack a little bit. The Pinkertons were hired by the Spanish government to suppress a revolution in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of influence that they had. I'm sure, in Spain, you can't just send over more ships to suppress it. You have to do it secretively by hiring a private agency out of the United States.
And there was a lot of pushback from actual Alan Pinkerton in regards to this, because the whole point was is the revolution was about the slaves essentially revolting. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, hold on a second. You're this huge, staunch abolitionist, but you're sending your people down to essentially fight against the slaves having the revolution in Cuba. So you have this enormous contradiction here.
This is, and I think it's you...
Like, I didn't think you guys were going to find out about what was going on in Cuba, so I don't really have an answer for you.
Yeah, we wondered what a bunch of white folks were doing down in Cuba during the revolution. It seems odd. But, like you and I had talked about in episode prep before, was... there was some sort of a turning point, and I think I kind of pinpointed it as once the James Gang shit went down and they sort of lost the public's sentiment in like a positive way, or lost the public's maybe attention, they were just kind of like, eh, fuck you. We're going to go our own way and do our own thing and make our own money. Like, if you don't respect what we do and I can't keep selling you on these things, then we're just going to go have our own fun, make our own money.
Oh, due to the recent wrestling episodes that were recorded, what comes to mind,
ooh, like I told you. I don't think those are out yet.
No, that we recorded. They'll be coming out in the future.
Okay.
This is the heel turn. Essentially, this is the first match when, although they may not have known it, people grew tired of the act or something, but it's when that first match comes out where the good guy, it's the Hollywood Hogan turn, where he comes out, he's there to rescue Lex Luger, whoever it was that was in the ring, and he tears off the shirt and goes heel. And at this point, that's what the Pinkertons do. They lost the public support out west, and they were like, you know what, at this point, it's time for us to get ours, and I think this is where money is. Money and morals take a big transition swapping places.
And part of it, too, this kind of comes in later, but I believe it's William and Robert. Two of his sons end up taking over the Pinkerton agency from him. And both of these kids didn't grow up in Goebbels in Scotland. They didn't see the bad side of
they didn't industry. They didn't have his experience in that this is what, you know, essentially where the direction that the company was heading at this time, more based on looking out for corporations and fucking greed and everything. This is essentially kind of due to how they were brought up without seeing that struggle of what like people were actually going through.
And that's still not to give him a pass by any means.
Oh no, because he was still alive until fucking 1884.
Yeah.
It's not like he was like, shut up, grandpa, we're running the company now. He still essentially had a hand in it.
Yeah. He could have shut down any of these things. Just like you said, his death happens July 1st, 1884. This is one of the grossest things that I've ever heard of in my entire life. There's debate about how he died. Some people think it could have been malaria from being in the South during the Civil War and getting malaria that way. Some people think that it could have been a stroke. But the general one that goes around, and I think it's because it catches all the headlines, he developed gangrene from biting his tongue.
Yeah.
And died from infection. I've seen pictures of gangrene in other places, and it's one of the grossest things ever. To think about that on a tongue is rough. Yeah. That's not a way that anybody would want
to
go out.
Well, if that stuff is like that close to your brain,
yeah,
and it starts to spread all of
infection
that kind of
doesn't
shit,
have to go far to shut some shit down.
Yeah, exactly. There's a reason why they cut off the stuff that's starting to get gangrenous. They just fucking chop that shit off around that time. During his life, he actually wrote about 20 books. I don't believe any of them were actually fiction. I don't think he wrote a lot of nonfiction, but basically these are kind of stories that he stated were like inspired or like detective novel type stories and everything. And most believe that the books were used as kind of a tool to almost sensationalize the business to attract new recruits and being like, do you want to be a spy?
Yeah.
All this kind of stuff.
Look at all this cool shit that we do as Pinkertons. This could be you.
How many people trying to join MI6 after fucking James Bond started coming out?
I'm sure they still get calls to this day of some dude that's stoned at home watching James Bond. And he's like, I wonder if they would take me.
Put Q on the line. I want to submit a resume.
It's just another recruiting tool that he could use with these books. And I don't know how popular they were. I know that they were popular enough that he had a couple of them that hadn't been published before he died that they published after. So they probably were doing some good. And he's also putting Kate in these books. And so he's drawing up more female agents that are going to be coming there to be used the same way that Kate was used. And she ushers in, they said something like she had shown up for her job or for with an application one day. He asked her what she was doing. She said, I want to work for the company. He says, as a secretary. And she goes, no, as an agent. And he was so kind of like taken aback by her forwardness that he's like, all right, we'll give you a shot. And then she just proved invaluable. Because like you were saying, a woman blending into society is so much easier to pick up information, I think, than a man.
And this doesn't go against her capabilities. That's not what I'm pointing out here. But just based on the time frame, I think maybe she was working for the company or she came in and expressed interest. And he was like, I see this more as a tool for me, not like to advance you. Like, I can use you and you're going to be a useful tool. He didn't look at her and been like, first woman spy. He was just like, oh, I can find uses for you. I think it was more that.
He had enough respect for her, as weird as it sounds, that she's actually buried with him and his wife. So
sold a lot of books.
Yeah.
She's like Clive Cussler, Dirk Pitt, the one that fucking McConaughey played in that movie.
Oh.
It's like how you have a character that just gets really popular in your series of books. She's his Harry Potter.
Well, and she was doing some shit out in the West where she would befriend like a train robber's wife.
Dude, it's still completely like groundbreaking. Yeah. I'm not getting at that. I'm just getting it at the point where I think it was more... It was her taking advantage of him using her for maybe not the reasons he said. But she took advantage and she succeeded in all those situations.
But either way you look at it, it's a brilliant strategy.
It is, yeah.
It's really incredible that it could be just that smart.
Well, it takes another turn where you see the company start to go full heel, where attention is essentially focused onto what's called... They become strike breakers, is basically what it's called.
Oh, not to cut you off, did you know that there was a Great Depression in 1877?
I heard a lot of references to it.
I had no idea before this that they had, it was called like the Financial Scary Times of 1873, or the Scary Times, I think, and then it was like full-blown depression in 1877.
Yeah, but the one in the 1920s was so bad, or what,
1928.
Okay, so the one in 1928, though, that's the most recent one, and that's when everyone looks at when it's like black... What was Black Tuesday or Black Wednesday or some shit like that?
It just blows me away because I don't know if the stock market was a thing at this point.
No, it just might have been the value of the spending went down, or there could have been a fucking drought and crops weren't. I don't know.
Well, also the slowing from the Civil War.
That's true.
And yeah. Reconstruction and everything like that. But just to think that there's a depression without a stock market sort of seems odd.
You're also still a new enough country where if you haven't run into this situation, you don't have a contingency and you don't know what kind of effect it's going to have on the economy.
Yeah.
You're probably like, our priority right now is essentially like winning this war. And then we'll have to worry about how bad it fucked up the economy. And so then they're like, we did not expect this.
What is this? I don't know, man. I just feel really depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we'll call it a panic, but then we'll call it a depression later.
So they start acting as these things called strike breakers. And basically what it is when you get unions starting to form in these steel plants, coal mines, railway, you know, depots, yards, whatever you want to say, you get them coming in and doing what they did to the Confederacy, starting to infiltrate these, finding out who the leaders are, who they need to go after. Because essentially, if you can cut the head off the snake of these unions, they're just going to go and fall apart. Especially when you have the education level is probably not very high for the common person. And people that are able to organize and speak eloquently and know what, you know, the intellectuals that are in those situations that are trying to form these unions of being like, we need better treatment, guys. We need, you know, more safety, things like that. Those are rarities.
Mm-hmm.
Even the next guy in line may not be capable of being like that guy. So if you cut those first couple of layers of, you know, essentially the command structure, leadership, these unions just dissipate. So they would send in these spies, basically, and find out who these guys were, sow dissent within, you know, the union, and try to kind of break these things up before they even got ahead of steam.
Well, you also had, as far as, I believe this is called, like, the robber baron age, and you have these people like Andrew Carnegie, who has cornered the steel market. And he has so many different steel plants all around Pittsburgh and all around Philadelphia that there's certain places that are literally just set up where they become like small makeshift towns around these steel plants. And when you start to get that kind of power over them to where they're just living in a city that's solely based around the steel plant, if you want to fuck with their wages, they don't really have a choice because there's nowhere else that they can go.
That's what I'm saying. Not only for that, but if they own all of the steel plants around that area, you're going to have to get out of that. And if that's the only thing you know, where are you going to go get another job?
Well, and they actually, this Homestead attack that we're going to talk about, that I'm so fucking excited about the episode when we do about it because it just sounds like so much fun. a terrible, terrible thing, but just crazy fun.
Went from one end to the other right there.
But
it's they so had, fun, this terrible, terrible thing.
They were a part of such a large company, and there were so many of them that they were a part of something called the Amalgamated Association, the Knights of Labor. Mm-hmm. So they had like a makeshift union that was already in place where they had like union lawyers and shit like that to go to the negotiating table with Carnegie and to some of these big robber barons and say, we need to figure out what we can do. But all it took was for Carnegie to be like, I'm just not feeling it today. You guys are asking for too much stuff. I'm just going to say no. And then they're going to say, okay, well, we're going to go on strike. And they're going to say, okay, well, we're just going to lock you guys out before you go on strike so you can't earn any money. And you're going to have to sit on the sidelines until you accept that this is just what the new normal is.
I got a ton of money. Yeah. I can outlast you. Uh-huh. I can take the losses. You guys can't take the losses.
And so you would run into these strikes.
But at the same time, they would still go on strike.
Oh, yeah.
Because Carnegie was like, I'll last before you guys do. And these guys were like, no, I don't think you understand that we can go on strike for a while. So they did end up happening.
Well, and they needed the Pinkertons to come down to these large steel mills and be able to secure them and make sure that nobody's breaking in or causing any havoc, that the peace is being kept. And that would turn into, it's sort of something that I think in society today, not everybody really grasps a hold of it. But if you have some sort of a strike or a protest, something like that, that's going on, if you bring a bunch of people into the situation, like law enforcement or like a private security company mm-hmm. that are all holding guns, it's going to start to cause everybody to be a little bit more on edge and panic.
It's going
to
escalate the situation.
Yeah. So when these strike breakers would come in and take security of the plant, what have you, wherever they are, the mines, they were always going to be armed, and there was going to be a lineup of them outside keeping the people on strike away from that area.
Yeah, there was. It was. I think part of it was like a provocation thing. I think part of it, too, was, you know, strikes are a little bit different back then because, again, you do have a mob mentality at a certain point, and it doesn't take much during a strike, of especially, you know, trying to put yourself in the position of someone who's underpaid, overworked. You are dehumanized, essentially, in the eyes of your boss just because the guy can. You're basically going to be pissed off, and if someone goes and throws a rock, guess what? That looks like a good idea. I'll throw that. And then you, all of a sudden you have the places on fire because someone's throwing a bottle lit on fire, some of that shit. So these things did get violent at certain points, but it doesn't help when essentially you bring in armed security and you're basically in a way kind of like trying to escalate or provoke the situation of something happening. Because if you do get something to happen, guess what? First of all, that's your, if one of the security guys dies, that's not one of your guys. That's hard security. If one of your workers die, guess what? Then all of a sudden you have that one up and say, see these guys. And now all of a sudden public opinion is against these laborers. And if public opinion turns against these laborers, you know, you don't have any support.
No. And you don't have any way to get what you need. And that's exactly what happens. July 6th, 1892, Homestead, Pennsylvania. It's called Homestead, Pennsylvania because the Homestead Carnegie Steel Mill just created a town of workers around it.
Which makes sense, because if you think about it, think of like a sawmill.
Yeah.
Like, you know, sawmills would, you know, pop up for lumber production, everything. You'd have all the workers there living there, then their families, then other people coming in because you need a store and you need this and that. I wonder how many towns actually started out. Like, you look at any town along like the Missouri or Mississippi or anything, you're like, probably a pretty good chance that like 50-50 those things started out as like sawmill towns.
Well, yeah, and you hear it now so much about once great thriving cities that were in the steel industry or the lumber industry or anything like that. But then when those jobs get shipped overseas, those towns dry up. It's exactly like Detroit.
Yeah.
Detroit was a thriving metropolis for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as the auto industry got out of there and went overseas, it just turned into a very depressed area because there was no jobs for all the people that were there.
Yeah.
So, the way that the strike kind of starts is the plant had grown and it kind of revolutionized this process of making steel beams and plates for like naval destroyers.
At this point, it probably wasn't destroyers. It was still just ironclads.
Okay.
Or like at this point, like probably steel clads. 1892, pre-World War I, even at that point. I think ship development is probably on the uptick, and I think that this is probably part of it. Because especially if you're starting to make plates and stuff like that for new, like, ocean-going vessels and things like that, if you're able to do that, you're probably making a lot of money.
This is why I love doing this with you, is because I can say something like that just not knowing anything of, like, what we had at the time, but you understand it so much to where you're like, no, this wasn't even close to the
I wish
right
I didn't have the
that.
Compulsion to do that.
No, I love that you do, because I love that you're providing information that I could have never guessed. I didn't know when they created Destroyer.
You're sweet. Thank you.
It's just, it's so fun to watch.
Well, what happens if you start to revolutionize, industrialize this process that took 10 guys to do, and now all of a sudden you got this machine that's doing the work of three of those guys? You don't have to pay them as much anymore.
Well, and employment grew as they kind of figured out these new processes, because you still had to make the old shit, but then you had, like, new assembly lines.
And you're also building more factories, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as employment grows, wages just continue to they just sink. There was like a three-step process where they just drop. And I want to say it was like 20% less was the final straw where they're like, nah, fuck you. This isn't going to happen.
Was Homestead where they had dropped wages three times within the calendar?
That's what I think it was, yeah.
Can you fucking imagine that? No fucking shit, you're going to go ahead and unionize and strike. Imagine getting a decrease in pay three times in 1 year.
And what do you do? Because he's the only game in town. If you want to go use your steel skills somewhere else,
you don't know anything else.
Yeah.
So you have to stay in this industry.
And he owns everything.
It's a form of servitude. Yes. How many, when he built these towns, how many of the fucking, like, general stores and all this kind of stuff, you got to buy clothes from him. You got to buy all this kind of, how many of the cleaners in town are, it's just fucking everything. It's a monopoly on it.
Getting you every which way, but
fuck just this Carnegie guy.
Regular taxes. They finally decide that a strike is happening. I guess Carnegie had kind of seen the writing on the wall, because they said, like, months before, they had noticed construction workers were going around the building and, like, fortifying it, putting up steel walls on the outside, just to kind of be like, okay, what's going on? They called it Fort Homestead because it just looked like a fort at the end of it. So finally, when they go on strike, it's decided that Carnegie is going to bring in these 300 Pinkerton agents. They were going to arrive on barges. Henry Frick was the president, or I guess he was the guy that ran the Homestead Steel Mill, so he was kind of the point man on this. Frick calls in the Pinkertons. 300 agents were supposed to show up on barges, because I guess they were closer to the river and it was like the easiest way for them to sneak in. The steel workers had kind of heard that something...
hot entrance.
Yeah.
300 agents showing up on barges.
I do think, too, maybe that was like the closest port of entry to get to the steel mill, as opposed to coming through town.
I look at it in the way that if you have all these strikers out there in front and probably blocking off a lot of the roads, you're going to get all those guys in a way in which they can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they do.
Yeah, so they kind of sense that something could have been up. The steelworkers would. And we're not talking about, like, just a few guys that work at the steel mill. This is the whole town, because this is their livelihood. So when the workers go on strike, basically the town goes on strike. These barges end up seeing these two barges that are carrying these 300 Pinkerton agents. They go ahead and head upriver in the boat back to the town. They're like, hey, they're coming. Everybody be ready for this shit. 4 a.m., they hit land when these barges right out in front of the steel mill.
Are we seeing this like Normandy? The ramps lower and the Pinkerton agents.
I would say maybe reverse Normandy.
Yeah, reverse Normandy.
Because when they land, they don't land to just an empty beach. Basically, everybody that was waiting for them in town is just standing on the beach waiting for these guys to get off the boats.
I feel like it's that scene off of Just Friends where the brother's like, the jig is up, run!
But the Pinkertons were hired to do a job. So the Pinkertons go ahead and drop the front of these barges. They start unloading. There's a lot of questions about who fired first in this scenario. I tend to believe it was probably the people that were paid to be there to quell a rebellion and that really wanted to survive, as opposed to the people that were just holding off. It could have gone either way. I'm not saying that the Homestead people were perfect in this.
No. You have to look at who has the easier justification, just from a mindset of saying, like, if you're hired to be there, provided security, and the owner of that place wants you there. Essentially, you have his backing.
Yeah.
So if it came down to a court case, who's going to hire you a better lawyer?
Definitely Carnegie, for yeah. sure. Yeah, so a firefight ensued. And all in total, this Homestead massacre, riot, conflict, whatever you want to call it, 16 men were killed, 23 were wounded. There's questions on both sides about if that number's higher or lower, but that's kind of like the general closeness of what it could have been. The attempted landing, like I say, took place July 6th, 4 a.m. when the gunshots started. And by morning, news of the attack had spread into Pittsburgh. And there were other steel workers that were going to come out to Homestead to support and help fight the fight.
Not only are you looking at something that could happen to you.
Yeah.
Chances are if they're able to move to help them, you've also probably got family there
yeah.
in that area. If your family is in the steel business. Or have been like a generation of like steel workers.
So they get pushed back onto the boats. And as they're out there on the boats, they said that they had cut like rifle house or rifle bearings so they could set their rifles on the side of the barges to mm-hmm. shoot back at the people on land. They fired volleys back and forth. This is where most of the people were killed. The people
who's also got the access to weapons.
Well, this is where the Homestead people get creative. And when I say creative, I mean super duper creative. Apparently, they had found a copper cannon in the town and had rolled it out onto the beach. And
like Civil War style?
Yes. And were firing like blunderbusses out at the barges, like trying to kill people. Not only did they do that, they loaded up a train car with oil barrels and lit it on fire and rolled it down the tracks to try to run into one of the barges and light it on fire and blow it up.
To roll how?
Because the tracks would lead down into the water.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
That didn't work. It hit the water and just stopped immediately and burned itself out. They did the same thing with a barge and tried to float the barge down the river into these other two barges holding the Pinkerton agents to blow them up and kill them as well. So these guys got super duper creative. Like the shopkeepers in town were just handing out bullets and ammo to mm-hmm. anybody that would take it to go out
have
there and fight them.
Have fun hunting, boys.
Yeah.
Like, if anyone asks, you were hunting.
Well, and it all worked because the Pinkertons were finally like, fuck this. We're not going to die for this. We're not getting paid enough for this. They said multiple times they tried to raise the white flag, but the first few times they tried to do it, the white flag was actually shot down, which... Again, a rifle at that time, I don't know yeah. how great of a shot it would be, but it's pretty funny to think about.
If someone's able to shoot that accurately, I'm telling you right now, more than 16 people are dead.
It's a solid point, yeah. Finally, they end up raising the white flag, and it's accepted.
An accepted white flag.
Yeah. They're marched through town, and it got so bad that as they were being marched through town, there were members of the Pinkertons that were pulled into the mass gathering yeah. around them and beaten unconscious and mm-hmm. just absolutely smashed to shit. They held them in the opera house, which I was shocked that a small town like this would have an opera house, but maybe it was big enough and these people were very cultured. I don't know about people from Pittsburgh. I don't really see opera in their
Carnegie
future.
Being like, we need to culture these people. Put it in a goddamn opera house.
There was a church and an opera house. So they held them there. Part of the conditions of release were that the Pinkerton agents would be held responsible for the murders.
If they'd be tried.
And of course they said, yes, no problem. We'll get that taken care of. July 6th at 5 PM. So they got there at 4 AM. This lasted all the way until 5 PM was when they surrendered. The very next morning at 10 AM, they're shipped by train to Pittsburgh. And once they get there, they're like, hey, all charges are dropped. Don't worry about it.
Yep. We got you guys aren't out there anymore.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. We
did they send all of you? They did. They don't have anyone.
No leverage.
Okay. You guys are off the hook.
So yeah, they got out of that whole situation without being charged. There were some people that were arrested on both sides later on. They were going to be charged with these murders, but they just decided that it was going to be too hard to prove who did it. So they just went ahead and dropped everybody. But the bad part about this was it basically blacklisted. They were persona non grata for any agency of the government to hire them to use.
Bad PR.
Yeah.
Creeps up again. And you got to look at it like the majority of people were the people striking. And I mean that in the sense of the majority of people could identify with the people striking because they were more of the common workers.
Oh, yeah.
You also have all of these politicians representatives, things like that, that are elected by these people. And if you're a representative or whatever in Congress and what, and you're looking like you're siding with the Pinkertons, you're not going to be around for too long. And so basically they passed this, was it the it was basically known as the Anti-Pinkerton Act or something like that.
Very poignant.
Yes, it was very, very pointed. And just like Adam said, it blacklisted any government agency to work with the Pinkertons, or I think it also just spanned out to anyone like from like a private agency like that.
And I don't know how far it went. I do know that after that, there were other agencies that had sprung up. There was even one that was started by a former Pinkerton agent that was taking over.
Oh, it was in 1883. Sorry, 1893 was when the Pinkerton Act was passed.
Okay, so a year after Homestead. So they acted pretty quickly. There were copycat agencies that started popping up, but since they weren't Pinkertons, they were looked upon a little bit differently. It was sort of, the Pinkertons almost had like a Kleenex effect, whereas Kleenex was the brand that just kind of was associated with detectives.
Well, and it makes sense too, because if their reputation is great, any new ones coming into the market in that scenario are always going to be second tier.
Yeah.
You get into that market that you know has some, you know, some money behind it, and all of a sudden you're like, we're different from them. We're the new guys. You know, don't use them, now use us. We're the better company that can provide you the same services.
We haven't killed anybody yet.
Yeah, we haven't firebombed any strikes yet or killed any nine-year-old children.
But I don't know if maybe this was sort of under the radar, or maybe we were just in such a dire concern during the World Wars, but they were actually hired to run security for factories during both World Wars to prevent sabotage.
Correct. At home.
Yeah.
Think of it that way. That's how much the government trusted them. You can look at it from the standpoint of like, hey, they're hiring us again. Or you can look at it at the point of saying, yes, they're hiring someone that has security experience, might know how to handle a weapon, to stay in the country and just guard weapons depots and things like that. You're not going overseas to do what you like to do, espionage and all that kind of work. No, no, no. We're handling that shit. We are just taking all the people that would normally be here guarding these depots, and we're going to use them for better, you know, better utilized services overseas.
Do you think when, if put your mind in the body of a German immigrant factory worker during World War I and World War II, and you hear that the Pinkertons are there and you already know the reputation, you're like, fuck, there's a chance I might get shot. It's the
Pinkertons. Yeah. Like, it sounds even less threatening. It's the Pinkertons.
You might as well just walk in to the security shack or whatever and be like, ask me all the questions you want.
Yeah.
I have nothing to hide because I don't want you to shoot me on accident.
They are keeping you here to guard the bullets, yeah.
But also the rise of the FBI and the Secret Service ate into their business, because when you have a federal bureau investigation that can go out and cross these state lines to track people in the Wild West down.
It's also the government just being like, why are we still paying outside people to do this? Let's just do this shit in-house.
Let's have full control.
Yes, let's have
J. Edgar Hoover this shit. Let's throw this guy in charge.
We're going to get all the fruits of this too, all the information gathering. It's not going to be privately held by these people. It's going to be all of our stuff.
Yeah, if they run across anything that we've done that seems unsavory, they don't have any leverage on us. Mm-hmm. So the FBI and the Secret Service just sort of changed the game, and it sort of changed their business model too. Because like we talked about, during World War I and II, they were a security company. They weren't really so much a detective agency anymore. They went into sort of this private security sector, and it was sort of a, I don't know. I think they did a whole lot. Like I said earlier, the agency's credited with creating the first national mugshot database, which is huge. Like that's a very big step forward in policing, to be able to know these people crossing state lines that are criminals.
This is a quick change of directions, and I think we might have touched on this just a tiny bit. So they were not under, like, they were not protecting the Abraham Lincoln when he was assassinated.
No.
So had they been, none of this other stuff would have ever happened. So if you're wondering, like, well, you know, where's the bad PR from allowing Lincoln to get shot? they essentially were off the hook for that. And then that's why 3 months later, essentially like, shit, we need a Secret Service.
Yeah.
And they created one.
Yeah, so, the Pinkertons moved on before Lincoln had Nixon.
Can you imagine, like, Alan was just like, oh, thank Christ.
Yeah. My buddy Lincoln died.
Because we weren't very good at this, and I know this would have happened on our watch.
Well, and he used Lincoln so much. I guess there's like one picture in existence.
Did you see it?
Yeah, of Alan Pinkerton. Lincoln's not even facing him. Like, they're not.
Lincoln looks so scary.
He looks superimposed into the picture.
He does, because it's like they've cleaned up and like Chris and, you know, like really sharpened the picture a lot. But like, man, I think meeting Lincoln in person, he seemed like a scary looking dude. He's so fucking tall and thin. And then his face just looks like it was, fuck, I don't know, just like carved out of rock.
He's a lumbering man.
But when you see him in this picture, he literally looks like Pinkerton's been saying some like bullshit to him. And he's turning around and just being like,
this motherfucker.
Get me away from this fucking guy. Oh, I can't believe I need this guy.
Yeah, he used it to his advantage. This was just another PR thing that he had in his pocket that he could use. So they kind of built their empire on just
the Pinkertons. Bet Lincoln would have wished he used us. That was their slogan for the longest time. If only Lincoln had hired us.
We would have stood in front of John Wilkes Booth. Mm-hmm. We would have pre-checked him before he got into the theater.
Ocular pat day. Down would have analyzed that he was carrying a Derringer.
Carrying a piece. But for all the shit that they went through and all the competition that they ran into, the Pinkerton Agency is still around today. And it's not to mention
the name. It's the name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the name carried enough to where in 1999, a company out of, I believe it's Switzerland, mm-hmm. called Securitas AB, bought the Pinkerton Security Company for $384 million.
Buddy, that name, it, like you said, it's Kleenex. Is if someone wanted to purchase Kleenex, that name still had so much. And at this point in history, in 1999, history is fuzzy. Especially going back as far as when, like, the shit happened with the strikes and everything. Mm-hmm. But the name Pinkerton has enough just recognition, even if some of it is negative, that it's why we still know about the fucking Pinkertons. Even though they're bought out, they really don't operate under the Pinkerton name or anything like that. They still use it sometimes, but we still know who they are.
Yeah, and until I really heard, I think, what brought me to it was exactly what you were talking about at the beginning. Like, I saw the Pinkertons in Red Dead, mm-hmm. and I had to really figure out if this was something real when I heard that there was a chance it could be, and then it brought me down this sweet Pinkerton rabbit hole. I don't know if they're as popular as...
Well, then they tried to sue Rockstar because they said that it provides a negative outlook. They end up having to drop the case, and I think Rockstar's argument was like, no, you realize that the Pinkertons go along with the Wild Wild, you know, the Wild West, like White Earp does, or like the Marshals. Like, it's just simply something so ingrained with the Wild West that it doesn't really apply. And they also make the Pinkertons look like assholes, which I'm guessing it's probably closer to the truth.
Yeah.
But yeah, they ended up having to drop that suit. But, you know, today they're providing more private security, what they call threat intelligence, risk management, which I see risk management and executive protection. I'm thinking Chris Hemsworth, Extraction style, mixed in with a little bit of maybe like Ryan Reynolds, the Hitman's Bodyguard type stuff. That's what I'm guessing that they have on loop at the Pinkerton Agency to show people what they'll be doing. But in actuality, you're probably protecting like Saudi princes with really shady shit going on. And having to fucking, like, bury hookers.
So, I did a little research here on the Pinkerton website. And, of course, they don't list any of, like, the breaking of the strikes or anything like that. But they do have all of their wins on here. In 1969, Pinkerton offices are established in Hong Kong, opening the doors to operations in Asia. 1998, Pinkerton successfully evacuates 431 expatriates from Indonesia during Asian currency crisis. 2005, Pinkerton mobilizes 313 agents to assist clients in the aftermath of hurricanes Katrina, Rita, and Wilma. So that's not people going down like FEMA to bring people out. Mm-hmm. That's companies that are trying to get their people out of town, so they hire a security risk management firm to fly into the hurricane to get their people out. Not just the public, just those people
it's
that work for
that
company.
Investment. It's the investment in the people. Like, we're going to hire you to go in and take care of or protect our investment. So that way, you know, when we have to rebuild, we get off the ground up and running and we can probably beat out any competition.
Yeah. It's just, it's so crazy the things that they do now.
And just to kind of give you an idea of like the kind of stuff they're still up to in regards to, I don't know, pseudo strike breaking espionage stuff. So in 2020, Amazon hired the agency to spy on warehouse workers monitoring union forward activity. So basically they were just looking for anybody that was trying to cause a stink for unionizing workers.
And not necessarily to like kill them like they used to.
Yeah.
It was more of like, so we have information to be able to get a leg up during negotiations if they try to unionize.
And then in 2022, wait, not two. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. 2022, Starbucks hired them to try and bust up union activity as well. So yeah, still in business.
And they're still everywhere, but they're places that you wouldn't expect them to. Any sort of like award ceremonies like the Emmys or anything like that, when you see those dudes in suits that are talking into their wrists, just like the Secret Service, those are Pinkerton agents. Those are guys that are hired for private security to protect those. A little thing called the Masters, Augusta National or Golf Course, their security is run by the Pinkerton Agency. So they're so ingrained in these giant things that happen in this country because they've been around for so long, but also because they know, I think, too, if shit hits the fan, these guys are very well trained to be able to handle a situation.
It's a PMC. It's a private military company to a degree. So the guys that they're hiring, they said it's strictly pulled from, like, special forces guys, people coming out with military training or, you know, military intelligence. So, yeah, still around. Protecting our golfers and fucking watching after the coffee beans. So good for them. All right, man. You got anything else on these guys?
No, I think I'm all Pinkerton out.
I'm all Pinkerton out too.
Pretty excited that we got to do this though. Cause like I say, I think it's something that people have sort of a knowledge of that they existed through different forms of media, but to know that these people were actually real and like still around today, like 150 plus years of service that these dudes have put in is insane.
All right, guys, thanks for joining us on another episode. Remember, rate, review, love those 5-star ratings. Send us your feedback. We love getting that. It motivates us to keep doing this thing for you, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Peace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another episode. If you like what you heard, hit that subscribe and like button. Follow us. If you didn't like what you heard, still hit that anyway, because we'll probably cover something in the future that you do like. Please follow us on our social media. Adam, hit him with it.
Our Instagram is historicallyhighpod, historicallyhighpod, and we are on Twitter at historicallyhigh, that's historicallyhi.
All right, and if you guys want to send in any feedback, suggestions, hit us up on those two, or you can even do it on Gmail. It's historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.
Peace.